Hello and welcome to Outside In Podcast. My name's John Burns, and this is the podcast for people who like to be outdoors. And I guess these days we're getting outdoors a lot more than we were. I was over on the Isle of Mull a few days ago, and I was sitting outside my tent basking in sunshine that I think would have been something you would have not expected to get in July. And then I came home back to Inverness, and the following morning when I got up, there was an inch of snow outside. So we're really getting some very, very changeable weather right now. And because of that, I thought, you know, there are particular challenges in Scotland's mountains when you get the very unusual conditions that we've been having. And I think, to be honest, we're likely to get in the future. So I've invited along the show today Ben Gibson, who is the Mountain Safety Advisor for Mountaineering Scotland. And I wanted to ask him about some of his advice about keeping safe in our mountains. Hi, Ben. How are you?
Hello, John. Yeah, I'm very well. Thank you very much.
Good. I did get your title right, didn't I?
Yes, you did. That was perfect. Yeah, no, great.
My God, it happens now and again. Yeah, I do get things right every now and again. But I don't know whether it's true, but it certainly seems to me that we've had, well, we just the winter that we've had has been very, very unusual, very windy, very mild, very dry, and then suddenly cold and changeable. Is that what you've experienced?
Yeah, I would certainly say, you know, that this winter for a lot of folk, you know, has definitely been a challenging one with what seems to be, you know, kind of storm after storm. And maybe the conditions haven't really been settled enough for a long period of time, as you would have normally had, you know, maybe, you know, 5 to 10 years ago with how winter, you know, was. And I think, you know, we kind of look back to all these winters and maybe sort of expect winter to be the same, but it's always changing. You know, it's never the same twice. You know, because I could think back of the winter of 2009 and 2010. That was a phenomenal winter with the amount of snow that we had, and it seemed like it was quite settled for long periods of time. And then moving forward, you know, we've had, you know, the beast from the east, you know, it was very cold, easterly winds, very dry. And it was a very different winter to what we have now. You know, we've had a very stormy winter. So over time, you know, winters do come, but they're very different, you know, to how they are from year in, year out.
Yeah. So I was thinking, I mean, obviously, you know, one of the challenges for that must be that for folk who want to get, if you like, experiencing what we would consider classic winter conditions where it's, you know, icy and there's a lot of snow, and it's actually quite difficult to get that experience these days. Is that true, do you think?
I kind of think maybe one of the bigger issues that has come to light now more this winter is maybe with just, you know, the pandemic that we've had, and coming out of that, I think more people have realized that there's more opportunity, or they've realized that, oh, I can actually go out into the mountains, I can go explore the outdoors and be a bit more adventurous and be trying increase my well-being, or get out of the cities as such, you know, to sort of feel like I can do something. And I think more people are starting to discover the mountains, which I think is great. And, you know, you know that you can access these mountains. But I think maybe the other challenge with that is that people are maybe just a little bit unaware of what they need to know to have a safer day in the mountains. So I think a little bit of knowledge to start with is a useful thing to maybe then realize, oh, maybe I need to have a bit more understanding and training to stay safe for the mountains, which in turn will allow me to have a more enjoyable day. So I think, you know, coming out of this pandemic, more people are definitely exploring and discovering the mountains, and maybe getting into a little bit of difficulty as a result of not having essential skills in how to sort of look after themselves out in the mountains.
So if you were to tell people, you know, if people were to ask you, you know, what sort of to go into the mountains in winter, what are the basic things that people should know and understand, do you think?
Yeah, so I think one kind of headline that stands out for me is kind of the idea of know before you go. Nowadays we have so much access to internet and, you know, how to get weather forecasts, you know, go and check, you know, Met Office or the Mountain Weather Information Service to look at what mountain specific weather is doing. You know, BBC is a good website, a good overview of the weather, but maybe only sort of at ground level, at sea level.
Yeah.
Where we need something a bit more understanding what's happening higher up in the mountains. And that's where we've got specific forecasts for that the Met Office provide and the Mountain Weather Information. And that'll start to give you a bit more of a clue as to what's happening higher up. And then you can start to see what you might need to put into a bag or a rucksack to look after yourself in those mountain conditions. And then with, along with that, you know, you've got the snow on the ground, which is another added challenge. So the Scottish Information Service is the forecast that would let you know where the snow is in the mountains, where maybe some other associated hazards are in the mountains that the snow can bring, and then how to maybe look at avoiding those hazards, and then just being a bit more prepared then as to what extra equipment that you would need to carry, such as crampons and an ice axe, to then look at managing yourself in that environment.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think has changed is that you see a lot of discussions, particularly on social media, and people asking stuff that seem very basic questions. I've seen discussions recently on the advisability of carrying, you know, will a particular mountain, will I need crampons to get up this mountain? Well, actually, any mountain under the right conditions, you'll need crampons, you know, but you've got to know that. And I've also seen discussion over, you know, the little kind, I can't remember what they're called now, the little sort of mini crampons you can get that have little tiny spikes.
Micro spikes.
That's the word I'm struggling for. Now, my sort of feeling on those is that micro spikes may be actually quite great for getting you up a mountain, but they might not be so good at getting you down. What's your feeling about micro spikes versus crampons?
I'll be totally honest and say that, you know, I would use micro spikes, but only on very low level tracks, and maybe, you know, tracks that are quite icy. And it might be that the track is a long way in to get access to the higher mountains, where then it starts to get a little bit steeper and there's a lot more coverage.
Yeah.
And micro spikes would be useful to a certain point. But in terms of then being on any kind of steeper ground or in the higher mountains, a crampon is much more appropriate and more suitable, because micro spikes, think of the name, it's micro, they're small. You're only going to get a small bit of purchase grip, where a crampon is more appropriate to the mountain environment that were built and designed for the mountains. And I think there's a bit of a misleading selling point with micro spikes. Maybe they're kind of dubbed micro crampons, and that word crampon is associated with them. So people think, oh, that's a crampon, where really that they're not. So they can have a use and they work to a certain point, but not for the high mountains, I would say.
It's an understanding of the sort of conditions that you might encounter, because obviously, I think if you're walking on a low level path that's got a lot of pools of ice, those little microscopes spikes are great. But anything above that, particularly when you're coming down, because you need to be able to, you obviously land on an icy surface much harder on the way down, and you need to be able to stop yourself. And with a crampon, you can drive the spikes in and they'll almost stop a bus, you know, but microscopic bikes, I don't think would do that. And there's even a very basic thing that often I hear people get into trouble with, is they don't take a torch. And in winter, a torch is like, I wouldn't go anywhere without a torch, you know?
Yeah, so in terms of the essential pieces of equipment that I carry in my bag right the way throughout the year and even into the summer would be a torch, like a group shelter, and that just allows you to get out of the wind and get a little bit of shelter, because the wind is the big thing that will make or break a successful day in the mountains, especially in winter, because it'll move the snow around the mountains, but it also kind of makes you feel really cold with that wind chill.
Tell us a little, sorry, can you just tell if someone who doesn't know, when you're talking about a group shelter, are you talking about a tent?
It's a group shelter is, imagine the most simplest form of the outside of a tent, you know, that would basically provide a little bit of shelter from the rain, but especially the wind, and it could be a big bright orange thing, so you're easily seen if it was an emergency. They pack down very small, they're very lightweight, and it can just live in the bottom of your rucksack, and you can get, you know, 2, 4, 6, or even a 12-man shelter. So they're very useful pieces of equipment that I would consider an investment for anyone.
It's basically like a big nylon box, isn't it, that you can sort of get into, and 3 or 4 people sitting in there generate a fair amount of body heat. And as you say, the important thing is that you're out of the wind.
Totally. And I think sometimes people have a misconception about them, that they should only be used in an emergency, but it's a shelter, you know. It's like just trying to dip inside to get out of the rain.
That sounds really good.
I've used them plenty of times, even in the summer when it's a wee bit windy and you just want some shelter to have a sandwich or put an extra layer on. And the difference they make in terms of a psychological feeling, you know, or a morale booster, they really help as well, you know.
Anything that gets you, gives you a sort of quick feeling of being out of the conditions is really good. Going back briefly to a torch, one of the uses of a torch that people don't think of, it actually can be quite useful during the day, is that a helicopter will see a torch beam a lot easier than it'll see a person. I know that from my sort of mountain rescue days. You know, you flash your light at a helicopter and it comes over and picks you up, which is really handy sometimes, you know.
A torch, like, it's definitely one of those bits of kit that I would take all season as well, just for when it gets a little bit duskier or dark or overcast, and you know, your visibility can change a little bit, it can be a little bit harder to see even when it's not completely pitch black, you know. So they definitely are handy for that, and just again for distance to be seen, you know, if it was a rescue situation, for example, you know, they can see a beam of light much further away, you know, and it's definitely more helpful for being spotted, for sure.
Yeah. So obviously now, what about navigation? Because that obviously is the key and the big debatable point in mountain safety, I think. So what are your views on what people should do to help themselves get around?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting topic of conversation that you could spend another hour talking over. But I think if you go back to the point at which GPS and phones didn't exist, it was always map and compass, and it was always people went and got, you know, some sort of basic training or formal training or a qualification that allowed them to develop the skills and understanding of how to read and interpret a map that related to the ground around them, and then how to use a compass, measure distance, how to take bearings, to walk in straight lines from point A to point B, and how to avoid the hazards along a journey in the mountains, and just keep themselves in check so they know where they were roughly in the mountains whenever the visibility was maybe bad. On a nice clear day, you don't really need to do that much navigation, because you might be able to see where you're going and where your objective is. So navigation would be a little bit more on the simple side. Then the navigation maybe gets a little bit more complex whenever the visibility is poor. But in that point, I always say to folk, if I'm teaching or helping them to develop their own skills, you're never lost in the mountains. You're just maybe misplaced or navigationally embarrassed. You know, so it's best just to stay calm and relaxed and allow your brain to think a little bit more logically rather than letting emotion take over. But then, you know, moving forwards into the modern sort of time that we're in now, GPS units and phones are everywhere, and we all carry them.
Yeah.
You know, we especially a mobile phone, and now that they have very good quality, quite accurate GPS functions, and there's so many apps available that allow you to read a map. I think it's now becoming a thing where you see a lot more people going into the mountains with just a phone navigate with. And I think at the end of the day, going into the mountains with some form of navigation is better than nothing. However, you need to be very mindful of the phone and the battery and how the cold can interact with that phone. Because that's the one thing that mobile phones like is the cold, and they just shut down and the cold drains the battery completely. You know, it could be that somebody has driven up to go climb a mountain or do a couple of Munros or a Corbett, and they've been listening to music on their phone in the car. It's drained the battery. Then they go and do the journey or out in the hill. The battery's maybe only got 20% left.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm always saying to folk, look, if you are going to navigate with your phone, have an appropriate app or some sort of navigational, you know, software that's going to help you understand the ground around you a lot more. Know how to use it properly. Can you use your phone with gloves on? You know, can you understand what that, you know, app is telling you? Make sure you've got a fully charged battery. Maybe switch off some of the background things, like put your phone in flight mode, so it's just GPS, and maybe carry like a power bank, you know, some sort of boost of energy that you can, you know, get your phone going in case you needed to make an emergency phone call, because, you know, other things will drain the battery in your phone quite quickly. But I think it's really important to also then think that, what if you drop your phone? What if your screen breaks and cracks? What if you forget it and left the car? You know, there's lots of other what ifs, and then you have to think, well, what other navigational tools do I have to get myself off the mountain? And if you don't have a map and compass, then it's a lot more challenging then, because you end up with nothing. So to look at this a complete navigational package, I think more and more people should be going with map and compass and maybe a phone as an addition to then just help confirm and just add to their confidence of knowing where they are in the mountain.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a difficult one, because a couple of years ago, very reluctantly switched over to GPS, because I'd been a sort of a map and compass devotee all my life, you know, and but my eyesight is not as good as it was. So particularly at night, I was finding it very difficult to use a map. And I thought, well, you idiot, there's something on your phone that will do this dead easy. But I think the tricky thing for, and I think there's no reason why, you know, most people getting into mountaineering now, especially the Scottish Hills, are going to use their phone, because you just take it out and it says there you are. There's no messing. But I think the difficult bit is, I think everyone needs to try and use a map and compass, because that will that really can't go wrong. A map and compass, it sort of works, you know. But the difficult bit, I think, is that it takes time to develop navigational skills with a map and compass. And so even if you've got them and you don't use them very often, if your phone packs up and you whip out your map and you haven't used it for a year or so, it's going to be difficult to actually navigate with it. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think, you know, the challenge is with, you know, using some sort of navigational app on your phone, it really only tells you where you are on the ground. And the screen size is very limited to telling you your surroundings, where a map and compass, you've got a whole mountain range. But it's the ability to interpret what the map actually tells you about, you know, is there steep ground nearby? What do the contour lines inform you of? You know, contour lines obviously being those lines that join areas of equal height and steepness together and give you a shape and a feel of the land. And like you said, that takes time to develop that understanding.
Yeah, it does. It does. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's where having some sort of formal training can help in building that confidence to know how to actually use those
I mean, I learned to navigate mostly by getting lost. I used to get lost quite a bit, and eventually I got lost. I still get lost, to be honest. But where can you go to get the sort of basic map and compass skills training that you think would be a good idea for folk?
Yeah, so I mean, if it's someone who's maybe an individual or a couple or something like that, you can go and look for like a local hill walking or mountaineering club and become a member of that club. And that club may also be affiliated with Mountaineering Scotland, who then would offer subsidized training courses for clubs and individuals. And there are other available organizations out there who would help to sort of give you those skills courses, like Glenmore Lodge or other individuals who run freelance organizations. You know, so there's plenty of opportunities out there. It's just having to go and search for them. And then maybe you might have a friend who has got some skills and experience that can impart a little bit of knowledge and wisdom as well, you know, and it might help you realize, oh, actually, I don't know enough, or I don't know what I don't know. So I need to develop this more. And I think if people are going to go out and practice and develop their skills to gain that confidence, start small. You know, don't be overambitious. You know, give yourself lots of little positive victories by going to somewhere that you maybe know and that you can feel accomplished, and go out on a nice day and practice your navigation when you don't have to think too much about the weather. And then once you've built up that confidence slowly, you could maybe then start to push the boat out and stretch your comfort zone of going into a bigger mountain. But then again, it's picking a day when it's really nice. And again, you've got that feeling of accomplishment as well.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I suppose it's like building up. It's like an upper staircase, really, isn't it? You're trying to slowly increase the difficulty that you're navigating in, and so you build it up. I mean, I think that navigating in mist is probably one of the most important skills, because suddenly, you know, a lot of your visual clues are shut down, or even at night, you know, that all of that helps. It's all just being able to look at a map and see the landscape, really. And that kind of takes time. There's no shortcut to that.
No, it's just being able to get out there and building up the confidence and experience of doing that. And, you know, and I've been out in the mountains working and my own personal stuff for almost 20 years, and I'm still learning. You know, there's other wee bits and pieces that, you know, somebody else might help or explain something in a slightly different way that you just suddenly, I know what that means now. Or you try something new and think, oh, that works much better, in being able to get from that point to that point rather than doing something else. But it's just, getting out there and having a go and experiencing it. And one way of maybe having a go at sort of learning it in a really fun way is actually orienteering. There's a lot of orienteering clubs that you can do, sort of urban orienteering around streets and cities. And it just helps you get an understanding of the important skills of how to actually orientate a map, find out where north is, how you can understand and describe the land around you. You know, especially when like you said, whenever the weather turns against you or the mist comes in or gets dark, you know, those visual clues disappear. So it's being able to feel what's happening around you. Is the land going up? Is it down? Is there any steep ground nearby? So it's just developing that skill, and orienteering is a really fun way of doing it now. You know, there's a lot of modern technology within orienteering that's all digital. It's really quite fun now. You know, this, you can do it as a very competitive thing, or just as a family oriented fun day out, where you can get this little electronic dibber, and there might be little tags around the short course. Then you can get a wee printout of the times and kind of where you were. So it's really quite fun nowadays. You know, it's not these old stamps and bits of paper.
Right. See, it's so long since I did orienteering. I thought it was back in the old days where you got your legs scratched by briars all the time. All that sort of stuff. It doesn't happen like that.
it's definitely moved forward. You know, technology is very useful in it. And it's definitely the reaching out to
a lot wider audiences now as well.
Oh, that's so great. I mean, one of the things I think is quite useful, you often go out with two or three of you in a group or possibly even more, you know, and what tends to happen is, you know, the bloke who's most experienced, or the bloke who thinks he can navigate, does all the navigation and everybody else just plods along behind him. And I think that's the motto in a way, or what you should aspire to, is really everyone in a group should be navigating, because you need to be self-reliant. And then, you know, so that way, two things that happen, really. Everybody in the group gets a bit of experience at navigation, but also if you're relying on one bloke and he makes an error, you're not going to get lost. Whereas if you're all navigating, the chances of you all making the same error are pretty small. Do you think that is that right?
Yeah, it's, again, this is another interesting topic of conversation about group dynamics and communication within group dynamics. It's interesting that I think it's very important that if you do go out as a peer-to-peer group, or someone who maybe does have a little bit more skill, knowledge, understanding, informs the group of, you know, where they are, what they're doing. You know, everyone have their own map and compass, so they can share ideas with each other, and everybody has an understanding of what's going on. Like you said, if something were to happen to that person who only has one map and compass, what best did the group have?
So yeah,
I think it's important that everyone within a group has an awareness of maybe a plan for the day. And then throughout the day, you know, kind of opportunities where they maybe stop and have a wee discussion, or like a key place where they can assess what the snow conditions might be like before they go up a steep slope, or, you know, carry on their journey. And I think it's interesting with some of the training that I've been delivering over the last wee while. I think it's really cool to see. And I really don't hope this comes across as sexist or feminist or anything like that. And it's not, but it's really cool to see a lot more women coming onto these courses, because they want to build their confidence to know that they can go out there by themselves and navigate, but also that they can actually have the knowledge to challenge somebody else in their decision-making, because maybe they might feel a little bit sort of put off by wanting to speak up and voice their opinion over somebody else who might be more experienced. And I always say to strongly encourage people that everybody has a voice, and everyone has the opportunity just to sort of express a concern or opinion, or ask a question of what are you thinking here? What's next? Where are we going?
Yeah.
Because it might just be then that person has observed or seen something that a more experienced person has easily overlooked, and that could be the difference of saving somebody's life from walking over a cornice, or you know, helping them go the right direction. So I think it's really, really important within group dynamics to be very open and honest and say everybody has a voice and everyone has the opportunity to speak about what's happening throughout the day.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I don't know, perhaps a more general point. It seems to me that the way we use the outdoors, the what we're doing in the outdoors, is changing now, and changing faster, perhaps, than it ever has. I think that the, you know, as you said before, we're coming out of a pandemic. We have a lot more interaction with technology than we ever had before in the outdoors. And perhaps what's happening, or it perhaps appears to me, that we're getting a lot of people going into the outdoors who perhaps we would not have traditionally associated as being outdoor folk, if I can use that range. Mm-hmm. So you've got people who maybe you're doing Ben Nevis just because that's all they're ever going to do. I'm going to do Ben Nevis and that'll be it. Or the sort of bucket list ideology, that you do a thing and you do it once and that's the end of it. Because obviously, you know, most folk in the outdoor community, if you can use that, build up their experience. Whereas I think there's perhaps a sort of culture of getting a one hit and going away. And obviously, if you just if the only mountain you ever do is Ben Nevis, then probably it'll be a bit dodgy in a way. is there any truth in what I've just said, do you think?
Yeah, I definitely think there is a change in how people are using the outdoor environment, you know, and it could be from a lot more social media influence and you know, people observing and seeing these fantastic, you know, photographs of landscape and people out, you know, enjoying a fantastic time out in the mountains. And other people maybe are looking at that going, oh, maybe I'm missing out on an opportunity here. I'll go do the same thing. But I think the challenge there is that a photograph maybe only tells you a brief moment, or it gives you a brief glimpse of what that person has done that day. It doesn't sort of tell you how much effort or how much planning went into that day, what equipment they carried, what's their experience of being in that environment. Where I think people will look at a photograph and go, oh, that person looks similar age to me. They've got a similar build. They're wearing similar clothes that I have. So maybe I could do that. Maybe that's appropriate for me. Mm-hmm. But not really knowing that actually there's a bit more to it than that. You have to put a bit more effort into planning, getting the right skills and experience, you know, and making sure you're actually capable of doing that yourself. So I think, you know, there's definitely influences from social media which can maybe have a negative effect, you know, and potentially put people into a bit of trouble.
Yeah. I think you mentioned joining clubs, and I think what one of the things that's happened with social media is that actually the internet has probably had a sort of negative effect on club membership. Because years and years ago, when I learned to climb, and it was all in black and white in those days, you know. if you wanted to know how to climb, you joined a club. That was the only way, really, and unless you knew somebody. But you can ask questions about mountains on social media. You can find out and the bits and pieces of information that you want. You can research it, but that sort of fund of knowledge that was around perhaps isn't around anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You think that's true?
I think there's lots of things that are changing that maybe a younger demographic of people who are more inclined to look for the information that they want, you know, from social media, you know, rather than going to a club. I think it's harder for clubs to maybe find, you know, younger members to come through and get the skills and the knowledge that way, where there's maybe a lot of influence from social media for the younger demographic, where it's maybe not the best place to seek the answers that you actually need. Because I think sometimes, you know, you see on some of these social media things, the questions going up asking, you know, what are the conditions like on this mountain, or do I need this equipment for this mountain? People are often seeking the answers that they need rather than what they actually have to have from a bit more skilled individuals or skilled kind of websites such as Met Office, Scottish Avalanche Information Service, where that's fact-based knowledge.
One of the problems is you don't know what you don't know, and that's you know, I mean, I always think that you know, you can't go into a mountaineering shop and buy experience. Experience doesn't come in little shiny packets that you can purchase. You kind of have to go out and get dirty and maybe get a bit frightened sometimes. And that's a hard truth. I mean, one of the things you did talk about, I had a sabbatical, I suppose you'd call it, for quite a few years from mountaineering. And when I got back into it, I was really surprised that most of the folks seemed to be, this is about 10, maybe 12 years ago now, most of the folks seemed to be older folk I saw on the hills. And that's partly sort of inspired the book I wrote, The Last Hill Walker, because I thought sort of hill walking was dying out. But I'm really pleased to say now, I'm seeing a very big shift when I go on the hills. There's a lot of younger people about. There's a lot more women The outdoor community used to be full of bearded blokes with hairy legs and even itchier socks. You know, that's changed. Yeah. That's changed. People even wear, you know, even attractive clothing on the hill these days, which personally I think shouldn't be allowed. But are there any final points you'd like to make on mountain safety? A final message, if you can give folk, before we wind up.
Yeah, so I think if I was to give a very clear and simple message to folk is, you know, the mountains are a great place to experience and have, you know, an amazing opportunity to feel great about yourself and get sort of fit and healthy, and even just mental health as well. It's a fantastic mm-hmm. place. Don't be put off by the mountains. Enjoy them. But to enjoy them in the best way possible is to get some skill, knowledge, and experience of how to look after yourself out there. You know, think about what equipment that you need for that environment, and, you know, have the skills to know that you can manage yourself if something were to go wrong. You know, and once you've maybe planned a day out in the mountains, and if you're going by yourself or even as a group, you know, tell somebody at home where you're going, you know, where you're potentially parking your car, how long you expect the journey to be, and what time you're expecting to be off the hill, and leave those details with somebody, because that just gives you a little bit of peace of mind knowing that there's somebody at home looking after you just in case you don't come back at the time they had expected to. And, you know, start small. Don't be overambitious. Take your time with building up that experience. And enjoy the mountains. It's no different than driving a car. You don't just jump straight into a car and off you go down the motorway from never experiencing how to drive a car. You go and get your lessons. You build up that experience of being confident to know that you can manage and handle a car. You pass your test and then you gain your experience. Being out in the mountains is no different. Start small, gain the experience, build up the confidence, and then you can then start to, you know, venture out into the bigger, wider mountain ranges.
That sounds like great advice, Ben. Thanks very much. Well, thanks, Ben Gibson. Been really fascinating talking to you. And let's hope we have some more safe experiences on our hills. Thanks very much, Ben.
Hey, John. Thanks very much. Now you take care.
Bye.